Here, thank you for your support of Houston's community station for over 50 years. 90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Next election is May 9th. I don't have to nag quite yet. Our first story is from click2houston.com. Family identifies Good Samaritan killed on North Loop while helping driver change tire. I know this is not the kind of story that I normally talk about on my show, but this is actually sort of like a PSA. You'll understand as I go along. A family identifies a Good Samaritan that was killed after he was hit while helping a driver change the tires on his vehicle Monday. Javier Leyva, 44, was attempting to help the driver of a silver Hyundai Santa Fe that had a flat tire as he was traveling on the North Loop East near Wallaceville Road. Officers said Leyva was driving a white Dodge Ram pickup truck when he stopped in front of a silver Hyundai and got out of his vehicle to assist the driver in changing the tire. A Toyota Corolla traveling westbound on the main lanes of the North Loop was struck from behind by an unknown vehicle, and the impact pushed the Toyota onto the shoulder, police said. The Toyota then struck the Hyundai, Leyva, and the pickup truck. According to investigators, the driver of the unknown vehicle fled the scene without stopping to render aid. Sergeant David Rose with HPD's Vehicular Crimes Division stresses the importance of safety on freeways. It's very dangerous to stop on the freeway at all, Sergeant Rose said. That's why we tell people if they get into a fender bender and no one is injured, get off the freeway. Anyone with information on the identity of the wanted driver is urged to contact the HPD Hit and Run Unit. I'll give you the phone number, 713-247-4072, or you can speak anonymously to Crime Stoppers at 713-222-TIPS, T-I-P-S. Now, I'm going to do a little speculation. I'm going to do a little education. Let's start with this. My speculation, I think what happened here was the Toyota driver saw Mr. Leyva and the disabled vehicle and tried to slow down as they passed, which is a correct maneuver. Also, moving over a lane would have been better, but I think this driver was trying to do the right thing. The unknown vehicle probably didn't notice in time that the Toyota was slowing down and hit it, and this is probably what caused the fatal chain reaction. Now, the first lesson is that if reasonably and safely possible, try not to get stranded or do repairs on a shoulder with fast-moving traffic very close to you. Attempt to limp, if necessary, to the nearest exit ramp and get off the highway. Many modern cars even have limp modes, L-I-M-P, limp modes, that will run the car at low speed even with engine problems. If the problem is a flat tire, consider sacrificing the tire in order to safely move off the road. There are also lessons here for drivers who see a disabled vehicle on the side of the road. Slow down. If possible, move out of the adjacent lane to give plenty of space. Also, as you slow down, be aware of traffic behind you. I was once in a similar situation with a sudden traffic slowdown. As I hit my brakes, I looked behind me. There was a pickup truck traveling at speed, and the driver was distracted by something next to him. I could see him in the mirror. I just thought to lean on my horn to get his attention, and fortunately, he heard that and looked up and hit his brakes in time. Disaster avoided. Accidents happen. Sometimes they're unavoidable. But sometimes being mentally prepared in advance can save lives. There are also resources you can call if your vehicle gets in trouble on the road. The list is really too long to read, but you can find it in this article at thinkwingradio.com, or, of course, you can go to click2houston.com and find the article. There are also resources like Transtar that are mentioned. There is 713 call MAP, M-A-P. There are phone numbers. It's worth noting that sometimes the respondents to these emergency numbers that you can call within Harris County, there may be a law officer or peace officer of some sort that responds. If that's something you want to consider, do, but you may have to weigh relative risks. Andrew, anything that you think you might want to add, or should we move on to the next story?
I think we can move on to the next story.
Okay. So from communityimpact.com, federal Hurricane Harvey grant to fund sweeping drainage improvements in East Pearland. The Pearland City Council will soon request federal funds to pay for drainage improvements in East Pearland. The city was awarded $2.7 million from the Texas General Land Office, or GLO, for the drainage projects, with the funding originating from a disaster recovery grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development after Hurricane Harvey. The projects consist of about 31,000 feet, or almost 6 miles, of roadside ditch widening, culvert replacements, and driveway replacements for improving the drainage in an area of the city with aged infrastructure. Construction will take place primarily in, I believe it's pronounced Hickory Slough Watershed, alongside sections of Garden Road, O'Day Road, Woody Road, and Scott Lane. The GLO-funded projects are separate from the projects in the drainage bond coming to ballots on May 6th in the election. They will be entirely funded rather by the Harvey disaster grant and will not require voter approval to commence them. My comment on this is that I suspect that these are the funds that were grudgingly allocated by the Texas GLO to the greater Houston area after years of legal wrangling that we have discussed on this show, because they basically, the Republican government in Austin wanted to allocate this money inland instead of like where Harvey hit. But better late than never, although sooner would have been better than later. Andrew?
Well, I'm glad that it has been allocated finally. And like I've said before on this show, I think any spending towards flood mitigation, flood flood preparedness, flood improvements are all very worth spending the money on.
Okay, our next story is from cron.com. Surveillance or savior? New data deepens divide over Houston gunshot tech. Since its implementation in December 2020, the gunshot detection system offered by ShotSpotter Technology, Inc. has become an ongoing subject of controversy and debate among Houston civic leaders, police, and city residents. Some view ShotSpotter, a network of auditory sensors for detecting gun-related crimes in progress, as a preventative tool safeguarding vulnerable communities. Others view the technology as an expensive surveillance network targeting black and brown people in lower-income neighborhoods. Earlier this month, the city voted to approve ShotSpotter's $3.5 million contract with the city, a move that renewed debates over the system's merits, effectiveness, and cost. On one side, there are Houston leaders and high-ranking officers with the Houston Police Department touting the technology as a vital gun violence prevention tool, one that HPD Support Services Command Assistant Chief M.W. Martin says has helped officers respond faster to shooting instances and recovery of evidence such as shell casings, thus contributing to 100 arrests. But Texas Civil Rights Project Outreach Coordinator Christopher Rivera is among those who say the data and numbers presented by Martin demonstrate ShotSpotter's ineffectiveness rather than bolstering its credentials. It seems a very ineffective tool, Rivera said, used mainly in Black, Latino, and poor communities. Moreover, Rivera said the $3.5 million ShotSpotter contract should be used for other resources that could also improve public safety, such as housing, education, and more. Unfortunately, he said, the rhetoric is strong in Houston and relies on a tough-on-crime police kind of agenda where our money is consistently spent on surveillance, over-policing, and jails. Rivera added, we know that funding should go to housing, eviction protection, debt relief, and to trash pickup. Both Martin and Rivera agreed that gun buyback programs, similar to recent incentives championed by Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner and Harris County Commissioner Rodney Ellis, could help decrease gun violence. This is a follow-up of a story that we discussed back in February. I was unconvinced of its equity and utility then, and if anything, I feel more strongly that it's both a waste of money and resources and discriminatory in that it targets communities that are believed to have more gun violence. They are therefore monitored for more gun violence, and then, of course, ShotSpotter validates that assumption by finding more. It's a vicious cycle, but not necessarily a valid sample. Andrew?
Well, I agree entirely, Mike. I think something interesting from the full article is how Christopher Rivera mentions programs like debt relief and municipal services like trash pickup as vectors for reducing gun violence. It's a good and, in my experience, very novel observation. Even a lack of very mundane services like trash pickup or a lack of support for problems that have traditionally been seen as personal responsibility, like debt, can be aggravating factors that lead people to commit violence that they otherwise wouldn't. I think this kind of spending is much more useful in combating all forms of violence than either police funding or gun control funding.
I think it's valid that poverty has knock-on effects that cause other problems. Okay, TexasTribune.org. After a two-year pause, feds give Texas the go-ahead to resume a major Houston highway expansion. Texas has resolved a two-year federal civil rights complaint and will move forward with a major highway expansion in Houston, a project neighborhood groups fear will displace residents and lead to more pollution. The Federal Highway Administration and the Texas Department of Transportation said Thursday they've struck a deal to allow the state to resume work on its $9 billion plan to add several lanes to Interstate 45 and expand other freeways around the city's urban core, which state transportation planners say is needed as more people move to the region. As part of the agreement, TxDOT agreed to take steps to mitigate the construction's impact on communities of color living near the highway. TxDOT must commit to more engagement with neighbors, including holding community meetings twice a year as they design and build the project. They also must pump more funds into affordable housing and help design parts of the road that can reconnect areas separated by the highway and do it with green space, among other stipulations. Texas transportation planners hope projects like the Houston Highway expansion will help reduce vehicular traffic as the state's major metro areas balloon and congestion worsens. However, transportation experts have argued for decades that highway expansions don't actually reduce vehicular traffic in the long term, and that the wider a road grows, the more drivers will use it. To activists who opposed the project and started the federal civil rights complaint, the outcome was a disappointment, and advocates urged federal officials to hold the state agency accountable. But with the Federal Highway Administration giving the state the go-ahead, activists have little recourse left to oppose the project and will have to try to shape the process through the community feedback mechanisms laid out in the agreement. Across the state, major highway projects have drawn fierce opposition in recent years amid a reckoning with how highway construction in the mid-20th century created and exacerbated racial and economic segregation. In major Texas cities such as Austin, Dallas, and El Paso, residents and community activists have pushed back against projects that they fear will disproportionately harm communities of color through displacement and exacerbate climate change through rising carbon emissions. In Houston, residents and community leaders warned that the negative side effects of the I-45 expansion will fall hardest on historically black neighborhoods like Independence Heights and the Fifth Ward, areas already dealing with rising housing costs, gentrification, and displacement. The highway expansion project is expected to displace more than 1,000 residents and 300 businesses. Andrew?
Well, I still hope that someone can find an angle to launch a lawsuit to stop the project. In the meantime, I hope that TxDOT is legally bound to the results of these community meetings in some way, and if not, that the people of Houston are ready to put rhetorical and material pressure on TxDOT to have them do what the community members want them to do. Finally, I'm sure there are plenty of civil engineering, racial justice, ecology, and public policy experts that will have ideas on how this project can be shaped to be not as bad to the affected communities and to the environment. So I hope the activists opposing the project will reach out to them and get them involved in the community advisory process.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download it with Google Podcasts, available from both the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other programs. Every story on this show is usually heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on Show Posts and More at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or the show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig and look for me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
The next story is from TheGuardian.com. And if this sounds depressingly familiar, I'm kind of with you. Republican is sorry for suggesting hanging by a tree as execution method. Tennessee lawmaker Paul Sherrill faced fierce criticism for grotesque suggestion in Southern state with history of lynchings. The Tennessee Republican state representative from Sparta apologized after suggesting hanging by a tree could be added to a bill concerning methods of execution in the state. Paul Sherrill made the suggestion on Tuesday during discussion of an amendment which would allow execution by firing squad in Tennessee. Sherrill asked, "I was just wondering, could I put an amendment on that would include hanging by a tree also?" He said, offering to co-sponsor the state bill. The remark prompted considerable backlash, particularly as it was made in a southern state with a brutal history of racially motivated lynchings. Last Wednesday, Sherrill said, "Sorry. My exaggerated comments were intended to convey my belief that for the cruelest and most heinous crimes, a just society requires the death penalty in kind," he said. "Although a victim's family cannot be restored when an execution is carried out, a lesser punishment undermines the value we place on protecting life." Sherrill said he, quote, "sincerely apologized to anyone who may have been hurt or offended." There are currently 47 inmates on death row in Tennessee. I find that I'm eternally shaking my head when I read these sorts of stories. Conservatives just don't get it. It must be a combination of education and intelligence and, I suppose, general ignorance. Andrew?
Well, you know, this story actually makes a very good case against the death penalty. The fact that somebody who could be casually racist like this is able to make laws in this society is proof positive that racism is widespread in American governance. If lawmakers can be racist, what's to stop the judges who enforce those laws from being racist? The death penalty is a power that would be given to judges, and if judges can be racist, then there can be no guarantee that the death penalty will be handed down fairly and without racism. If a power cannot be used fairly, it cannot be wielded responsibly. And if it cannot be wielded responsibly, it should not be in the hands of the state.
And you know what occurred to me as I was reading that story?
What?
I suspect this Representative Sherrill may have been the kind of person in the 19th century that went to public hangings for entertainment.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Quite possibly. Okay, our next story is from APnews.com. New Mexico may curb paramilitaries near the southern U.S. border. Legislators in New Mexico are advancing legislation to rein in paramilitary patrols that have popped up in recent years to halt migrants near the international border with Mexico and at a protest over a statue of a Spanish conquistador. The bill places New Mexico among several states weighing changes this year to restrictions on paramilitary organizations. Lawmakers in Oregon and Vermont also are considering initiatives aimed at limiting activities by private militarized groups. Legislators in Idaho are moving in the other direction by advancing a bill to repeal a state law banning private militias, despite criticism that the move could dangerously embolden existing paramilitary groups in the region. A narrow ban on municipal-run paramilitary groups would remain in place. The bill emerged Monday from House committee vetting for a possible floor vote with the backing of Democrats. Republican House legislators have raised concerns that the proposal could interfere with neighborhood watch style groups that respond to crime or limit opportunities for businesses in New Mexico that have provided tactical training to visiting security forces. In other words, they're pro-vigilante. Democratic State Rep. Raimondo Lara said the proposal doesn't interfere with private firearms training or with New Mexico's relatively permissive gun laws that allow both open carry of firearms and concealed handguns with permit and training requirements. The proposal responds to incidents in 2019 in which armed members of the United Constitutional Patriots, of course, whenever they talk about patriots in their name, they're probably not, this group stopped migrants near the international border in southernmost New Mexico at Sunland Park, and in 2020 when men with long guns and tactical equipment showed up at a chaotic protest in Albuquerque about a statue of early Spanish settler Juan de Oñate, who is both revered and reviled. The bill defines a paramilitary organization as a group of three or more people with a command structure aimed at functioning in public as a combat enforcement or security unit. Banned paramilitary activities also include interfering with government operations or government proceeding and actions that deprive others of their rights. Paramilitary groups also would be prohibited from posturing deceptively as peace officers. Armed civilian groups have been in intermittent presence on the border for years, portraying themselves as auxiliaries of the U.S. Border Patrol and operating in areas where agents are not stationed. Of course, in my opinion, defining a paramilitary group in legal terms will be tricky, but it's long overdue. I've been hearing about these groups growing ever since Bill Clinton was president, and they always seem to grow when Democrats are in power and wane when Republicans are in power. I've felt for years that whether we're discussing street gangs or paramilitary groups, we're actually seeing nascent warlordism. One gang's extortion is another group's taxes. Warlords thrive in territories with weak governance known as fragile or failed states. All these paramilitary groups are basically run by wannabe warlords. Understanding that is one of the first steps in controlling them. Andrew?
Well, I understand the motivation for these bills, and I agree that right-wing paramilitaries are a real problem, but I'm worried about the bill's scope. The left wing has a long tradition of taking up arms to defend ourselves and the working class, and as a socialist, that's a tradition I support to this day. The U.S. and other capitalist governments similarly have a long tradition of taking up arms to suppress the left and oppress the working class. We see this in things like the dubious terrorism charges brought against peaceful protesters, to say nothing of events like the Battle of Blair Mountain. I worry that these bills present another avenue for suppression of groups as small as left-leaning gun clubs, all the way to community defense and civil rights groups like the Black Panthers. I think the biggest reason these right-wing paramilitaries have been able to operate and grow is that the government doesn't pursue them nearly as strongly as they try to infiltrate and disrupt the left, even pacifist activist groups. The most appropriate action to take against right-wing paramilitaries is to fairly enforce laws that already exist, and not just let these right-wingers off the hook because they have police buddies.
I once did a show some years ago where I ran across an article that I have not seen contradicted, in fact, that the U.S. may have the bloodiest labor history in the world.
Wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me after what I've read either. There are ample examples of either private security groups using force against labor or the U.S. military using troops or reserves against labor. So I hear what you're saying. However, in principle, I don't condone any extra governmental military group that wants to take the law into their own hands. I don't approve of it on the right. I don't approve of it on the left. And of course, part of that has to be a government that is fair and even-handed, which, as I often remind people, is formed generally by who you vote into office. So elections still have consequences. Andrew, anything you want to add?
I think I take a lot of your points. I think the best way to not have these kinds of community defense groups is to not need them. And the way that you don't need them is by having a government that is actually under the control of the people and not the other way around. Unfortunately, I don't think we have that in the U.S., and I don't think we will have that so long as profit is the goal of the day, the order of the day.
I think that the term community defense group, though, is something of a euphemism for a paramilitary organization. In the course of kind of thinking about this article and how I might respond to it, I looked up the term warlord. And it's kind of interesting. You know, there is actually, like, you have presidents of republics and you have kings of realms and terms like that. There is actually no word I could find for the area controlled by a warlord, except that it's the area controlled by a warlord. I think that any leaders of these kinds of armed militias, paramilitaries, whatever you want to call them, whether it's a street gang, you know, a street gang extorting businesses on their turf for money, is that really any different from a militia or a revolutionary group taxing the people under their control? One man's extortion is another man's taxes. I think that it's really important not to give one side a pass while saying that the other side is bad. I think that extra governmental militaries are an introduction to civil chaos.
Well, as I once heard somewhere, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So,
yeah, it depends on how history is written. There is truth to that. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org from anywhere in the world. Download, which I recommend, with Google Podcasts, available from the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and to be that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org, hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, perhaps Think Wing Radio, and the amount of your donation, which can be large, small, or in between, and you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And tell people about KPFT and whatever your favorite shows may be, because spreading the word helps too, and it's free. Okay, this is actually a little bit of an excerpt of a longer article because it's sort of an ongoing piece that is updated about events in Ukraine. I just thought this was interesting. From CNBC.com, Ukraine's representative at the UN warns that Russia is slated to lead the Security Council next month. This is actually interesting. Sergei Kislytsia, Ukraine's permanent representative to the UN, urged the international forum to prohibit Russia from holding its scheduled one-month presidency over the Security Council. Kislytsia raised the issue on Twitter by saying the saddest day in UN history will be when Russia presides over the Security Council on April 1st, a handful of weeks after the one-year anniversary of Moscow's full-scale invasion. Russia is a permanent member of the Security Council, which is based in New York City and serves as the UN arm tasked with maintaining peace and security. Russia also holds veto power in the Security Council, which can hamper any decision-making in regard to supporting Ukraine. Andrew did some work on this.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research, and it does seem that if a country becomes president of the Security Council, that's country, not leader of a country or person, while they're involved in a war that the council is discussing, their permanent representative, who is their representative on the Security Council, is expected to temporarily step down. Now, I'm not sure if that changes what country holds the presidency or what exactly happens after they step down, but there is at least a norm in place for this situation. Whether Russia cares enough about looking good at the UN to abide by that norm or not, I don't know.
And that's excellent work, Andrew. I had no idea about any of that. But as you cite it, however, the, quote, permanent representative is expected to temporarily step down. If this is anything like a Supreme Court justice being expected to recuse in the case of a conflict of interest, a rule with no teeth, I wouldn't hold my breath. And the other point is, Russia may dispute the allegation that they're at war since they claim they're engaged in a special military operation.
Yep.
So that may be a loophole that they decide to exploit. Because, as Rudy Giuliani once said, truth isn't truth. Our next story is from the Washington Post. I thought this was kind of interesting, so I gave it some space. A global divide on the Ukraine war is deepening. Russia capitalizes on disillusionment with the United States to win sympathy in the global South. Clement, and I'm just going to apologize in advance for mispronunciations. Clement Manyathela, who hosts a popular and influential talk show on South Africa's Radio 702, remembers the outrage he felt when Russian troops first surged into Ukraine. He had believed Russia's insistence that it wasn't planning to attack and felt cheated when war broke out. We were lied to, he said. But as the fighting continued, he and many of those who call into his show began to ask questions. Why had President Vladimir Putin deemed it necessary to invade? Was NATO fueling the fire by sending so many weapons to Ukraine? How could the United States expect others around the world to support its policies when it had also invaded countries? When America went into Iraq, when America went into Libya, they had their own justifications that we didn't believe, and now they're trying to turn the world against Russia. This is unacceptable, too, Manyathela said. I still don't see any justification for invading a country, but we cannot be dictated to about the Russian moves on Ukraine. I honestly feel the U.S. was trying to bully us, he said. In the year since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a reinvigorated Western alliance has rallied against Russia, forging what President Biden has trumpeted as a global coalition. Yet a closer look beyond the West suggests the world is far from united on the issues raised by the Ukraine war. The conflict has exposed a deep global divide and the limits of U.S. influence over a rapidly shifting world order. Evidence abounds that the effort to isolate Putin has failed, and not just among Russian allies such as China and Iran. India announced last week that its trade with Russia has grown by 400% since the invasion. On Friday, February 17th, a year after the invasion began, the South African Navy will be engaged in military exercises with Russia and China in the Indian Ocean, sending a powerful signal of solidarity at a moment the United States had hoped would provide an opportunity for reinvigorated worldwide condemnations of Russia. Russia's invasion of Ukraine sent shockwaves around the world as grain shipments were delayed and Russian gas curtailed. Conversations with people in South Africa, Kenya, and India suggest a deeply ambivalent view of the conflict, informed less by the question of whether Russia was wrong to invade than by current and historical grievances against the West over colonialism, perceptions of arrogance, and the West's failure to devote as many resources to solving conflicts and human rights abuses in other parts of the world. This is not a battle between freedom and dictatorship, as Biden often suggests, said William Gumede, who founded and heads the Johannesburg Democracy Works Foundation, which promotes democracy in Africa. He pointed to the refusal of South Africa, India, and Brazil to join Biden's global coalition. That reluctance, he said, is the outgrowth of more than a decade of building resentment against the United States and its allies, which have increasingly lost interest in addressing the problems of the global South, he said. As the West pulled back, both Russia and China stepped into the vacuum, aggressively courting developing nations and capitalizing on the disillusionment with the United States and Europe by presenting an alternative to perceived Western hegemony. The Middle East and Africa are key battlegrounds in this struggle for hearts and minds, as are Asia and, to a lesser extent, Latin America, whose fortunes are more closely bound by geography to the United States. The Middle East is one region where Russia has succeeded in winning friends and influence, said Faisal, a retired Egyptian consultant on organized crime in Egypt. Of course I support Putin, he said in an interview in Cairo. A long time ago, we lost faith in the West. All the Arabs on this side of the world support Putin, and we are happy to hear he is gaining lands in Ukraine. Despite Western efforts to attribute global inflation and a food crisis to the Russian invasion, most countries around the world blame the West for the imposition of sanctions, said Kanwal Sibal, a former Indian foreign secretary. They do not subscribe to the narrative that countering Russia is a moral imperative if the principles of democracy and territorial integrity and the rules-based world order are to be upheld, Sibal said. That's not an argument that serious people buy, he said, citing the NATO bombing of Serbia, U.S. support for dictatorships during the Cold War, and the Iraq War as examples of what he sees as the United States violating those same principles. The rest of the world genuinely sees this as a European war. They do not see a global conflict or the way it is presented by the West. Yes, it is international, repercussions such as inflation, but those repercussions are because of the sanctions. There's much more to this article that discusses politics and policies and, to use the writer's word, hard-headed choices made by governments about what is in their own interests regarding which side to pick or to pick any side at all. And we turn the page. Looking at the map in the story, there is a map in the story. The Russo-Ukrainian War is definitely a Northern Hemisphere war, but it has serious repercussions in the hemispheric South. In some ways, World War II was similar. Many countries in the uncolonized Southern Hemisphere remained neutral as they could, as neutral as they could during World War II, even while being heavily impacted by it in one way or another. I think the positions and the opinions articulated in the story give the reader much to think about, both personally and geopolitically. Andrew?
Well, I think that was a very reasonable response from you, Mike. I think I'm a little bit more outspoken on this, but I think I'm broadly in the same position, as you just described. Russia was obviously wrong to invade uncontested Ukrainian territory, and is wrong to support oppressive occupational governments in both the breakaway regions and the uncontested Ukrainian regions that Russia is occupying. But I agree with many folks in the article who say that who is wrong and right now is not the only thing that matters. I really think it's easy to see why every side in this conflict holds the opinions they do. Russia needed to push back against NATO, but Putin's conservative party also needed nationalist fervor like the kind provided by an invasion in order to hold power in Russia. The U.S. and allies oppose the invasion because Russia is refusing to respect the boundaries of another sovereign nation, but also because NATO countries will oppose Russia and China any chance they get in order to preserve and expand their own soft power abroad. Countries in the global South see both of these motivations and arguments, but have to keep their own interests in mind, namely which power bloc is providing them the most benefit, more honestly, for the least imposition of influence. It's a complicated situation, and those are the least fun.
Well, we have a fundamental disagreement on this issue. Any claim that Putin had to legitimate security concerns, in my opinion, ended when he invaded Ukraine for what amounted to the second time. If anything, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is proof that NATO needs to exist because the only proven expansionist aggressor state in Europe since World War II has been Russia. They invaded Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968. Under Stalin, they split Poland with Hitler and never gave that part back. They invaded Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania and never withdrew. Also, I must mention they took a piece of Finland while they were at it. The enclave of Kaliningrad was actually part of Eastern Germany, and they never disgorged that either. It's been attributed to Cyrus Vance in the 1960s that Soviet negotiating tactics were basically, what's ours is ours, what's yours is negotiable. To my admittedly lay knowledge, this has been pretty much true through most of the 20th century and into the 21st.
I disagree, not least because Russia and the Soviet Union are two different states. But for more of my disagreements and arguments, and some of Mike's, feel free, you listening, to head over to the blog post for this show at thinkwingradio.com.
Yeah, we actually tried to keep it short, believe it or not.
Yeah. Tried okay. is the operative word.
Yeah, exactly. From the NewYorkTimes.com, intelligence suggests pro-Ukrainian group sabotaged pipelines, U.S. officials say. New intelligence reviewed by U.S. officials suggests that a pro-Ukrainian group carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines last year, a step toward determining responsibility for an act of sabotage that has confounded investigators on both sides of the Atlantic for months. U.S. officials said that they had no evidence President Zelensky of Ukraine or his top lieutenants were involved in the operation, or that the perpetrators were acting at the direction of any Ukrainian government officials. The brazen attack on the natural gas pipelines, which link Russia to Western Europe, fueled public speculation about who was to blame, from Moscow to Kyiv and London to Washington, and it has remained one of the most consequential unsolved mysteries of Russia's year-old war in Ukraine. U.S. officials said there was much they did not know about the perpetrators and their affiliations. The review of newly collected evidence suggests, the review of newly collected intelligence suggests they were opponents of President Putin of Russia, but does not specify the members of the group or who directed or paid for the operation. Officials who have reviewed the intelligence said they believed the saboteurs were most likely Ukrainian or Russian nationals, or some combination of the two. U.S. officials said no American or British nationals were involved. As they say on detective shows, proving a crime requires means, motive, and opportunity. There are lots of characters in this story with motive, but not that many with the means. Opportunity, on the other hand, may have been created by a relatively low level of security around the pipelines. We may have to wait for the movie to come out before we know who did it. Andrew?
Yeah, honestly, there's nothing, there's always some kind of twist happening with this whole situation. Like, and of course it's a war, right? That's going to happen. But we have secret attacks on pipelines and, different countries trying to push their view of the war. There's going to be a lot of secrets like this that many I don't think we even know about yet that are going to, we're not going to find much out about until 20, 30, 40 years later.
Until
the movie comes out. Exactly.
When this bombing first occurred, and I remember mm-hmm. we discussed the story at the time, yep. and it never made sense to me to point fingers at the Russians. I mean, they were using terms like revenge, and you'll see how much you miss the gas when the pipeline is gone. It never made sense, the motive yeah. for the Russians, given their investment and their need to sell the gas and the tens of billions of dollars they'd spent, just never made any sense.
Yeah.
The strongest motive was always the Ukrainians.
Hmm.
But the United States has never been happy about the Nord Stream pipelines. They've tried mm-hmm. for decades to get the Germans to not become reliant on Russian natural gas. The British, basically the same thing. The French, basically the same thing. The French are focused on nuclear power, so they've yep. never been wanting to get dependent on Russian natural gas. But then you get to the means. How many countries or how many groups have the resources to get a group of divers to go down? I think they said it was something like 230 feet. So it's not like going to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, but it's really deep. That yeah. kind of pressure is really tough, and it takes a really skilled diver or group of divers to be able to execute any kind of a mission at that depth. And then you're considering having I think that the number was hundreds of pounds of explosive, of high explosive.
Something like that, yeah.
Put in two or three locations on the pipeline. And this is with all kinds of sea traffic going on overhead and a certain amount of national security from Denmark and Norway and Sweden. And, this took money. This took resources. This took yeah. know-how. This took equipment. It's not something that some paramilitary unit in Wyoming could pull off.
Yeah.
So means becomes a real issue here. And even Ukraine, I think, would have trouble pulling off the means to do this. So this really is a genuine mystery.
Yeah. And let's not forget, this is still like coming from an intelligence agency. They could well be lying for some reason, for whatever, you know, benefit that we, again, probably won't find out about until the movie comes out. So
that's going to be the slogan from now on.
Yeah. That's a, we've coined a phrase there. Put it on a t-shirt, sell it. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're just going to have to wait and see if we ever see, really, because we might not. Who knows?
And I came up with what I think personally is a great coined phrase for taking facts and basically lying about them. You know, they use the term whitewashing, and especially over the last couple of decades, I've begun to have problems with that phrase when I hear it. So I've decided that the new phrase should be foxwashing.
Okay.
So now when someone wants to put a veneer of lies over something that might actually be true, it's not whitewashing, it's foxwashing.
Hmm.
Yeah, just a thought. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. I'm also a coiner of phrases on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download it with Google Podcasts, of course, I recommend, available on both the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. I always like to note, we heavily excerpt pretty much every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles on the show posts and more pages, as well as basically our script, going to thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's 713-526-KPFT, extension 1. And you can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. And we're on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. There is a theme here. And I am on Twitter at Think Wing Radio because I have no imagination. Plus, Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
The next story is an opinion piece from TheHill.com called Will the Non-Russians Rebel? This is actually from a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it was worth mentioning at some point. As the Russian language liberal website Medusa reported, the Russian Federation's non-Russian nations may be on the verge of asserting themselves as sovereign actors and accelerating Russia's collapse. The irony would be too sweet. In attacking Ukraine, Putin could wind up dismantling Russia, thereby demonstrating that unintended consequences can be deadly. The Free Nations of Russia Forum, the FNRF, is the emigre non-Russian political grouping that hopes to replace the Russian Federation with a series of independent states. The FNRF was founded in 2022 by Ilya Ponomarev, an ex-member of the Russian Duma, who opposed Putin's annexation of Crimea in 2014 and denounced his invasion of Ukraine in 2022. A vociferous opponent of the Russian dictator and his fascist regime. Now, mind you, this is an opinion piece. Ponomarev currently resides in Ukraine. The forum has met five times, most recently in late January of 2023. Attending, this is where it gets interesting, attending the conferences were representatives of regions that most readers probably have never heard of. Siberia, Cherkessia, Ichkeria, otherwise known as Chechnya, the Pskov Republic, the Laplandia Republic, also known as Murmansk, the Nogai Republic, the Don or Kazakhia Republic, Tatarstan, Ingria Latvia, the Moscow Republic, the Kuban, Bashkortostan, Sakha, also known as Yakutia, Königsberg, also known as Kaliningrad, Karelia, Ingushetia, Buryatia, and Idel-Ural. It would be premature to dismiss the forum as a meaningless emigre conclave. Although the tone of Medusa's report was skeptical, its reporter did attend and write a lengthy piece, suggesting that the issues that concerned the gathering were worth attention. Putin's propagandist in chief, Vladimir Solovyov, also made fun of the event, a sure sign that he's worried, as is Putin, who has spent two decades chipping away at the prerogatives of Russia's non-Russian administrative units. Most recently, he effectively reduced Tatarstan to a mere province of the Federation, as opposed to a nationality. Russia's non-Russian nations have borne the brunt of the fatalities thus far. At some point, they will ask whether it's better to submit to Putin's destructive schemes or to bolt. Not because they will necessarily have been influenced by the Free Nations of Russia Forum, but because secession will be the only guarantee of survival in the deadly chaos that seems to be Russia's unavoidable future. Just FYI, it's just worth mentioning that in this case, the author is a professor of political science at Rutgers University in Newark, a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. So not just a guy kind of blowing smoke. As always, this article was extremely excerpted for the show. Click the link to read it in full. Andrew?
Hey, I've heard of Siberia. I've not heard much other than it's cold there, but I've heard of it. More seriously, I think the characterization of Russia under Putin as fascist is a bit hyperbolic, as they haven't checked off every warning sign of fascism, though Russia under Putin is certainly autocratic, and rather telling about where the author's biases lie. But this is an interesting hypothetical, and it's an opinion piece. I certainly think that Putin did not expect the invasion of Ukraine to go as poorly as it has for him, and I think a primary motivator of it was, as I said earlier, to appeal to that conservative nationalist sensibility that his party has based its support on. The invasion is embarrassing that sensibility and Putin's political presence, I think, which has been holding Russia together through a lot of unpopular policies and decisions. Without that presence to hold the country together, some regions will find breaking away to be a lot more feasible than at any other point in recent history. Whether it will be feasible enough to accomplish, and whether the people in those regions will support secession, remains to be seen.
I mean, I have to say, how likely is the potential outcome outlined here in the article? Mm. Is it any more or less likely than the U.S. South rising again? The only answer to give is whether someone in 1989 would have expected the USSR to be dissolved by 1991. Mm. It's anyone's guess, but this article qualifies, I think, as informed speculation. Our next piece is from thehill.com, from, again, a couple of weeks ago. The title is "The Fifth Person Was Cured of HIV After Stem Cell Transplant," researchers say. Researchers from Germany say a man has been cured of HIV following a stem cell transplant that was performed after several rounds of chemotherapy, making him the fifth known case of the virus being cured in an individual. In the study published in the Nature Science Journal, German researchers detailed the case of a 53-year-old patient who was diagnosed with HIV in 2008. During the patient's treatment for their cancer, they received a stem cell transplant from a female donor with whom they matched. This transplant occurred roughly 2 years after their cancer diagnosis and 5 years after being diagnosed with HIV. The female donor had a mutation that is believed to confer resistance to HIV infection. Testing of the patient following treatment was unable to find traces of virus capable of replicating and infecting cells. Antiretroviral therapy, or ART, was ultimately discontinued in the patient in 2018, 10 years after they were first diagnosed with HIV. After ceasing ART, the patient displayed no symptoms of HIV. Timothy Ray Brown, the first patient believed to be cured of HIV, received the same kind of transplant as the Dusseldorf patient in 2007 to treat his leukemia. It was reported last year that a woman had been cured of HIV also through the use of stem cell transplant, with these cells harvested from umbilical cord blood. Two other cases of HIV being cured are believed to have occurred when the two patients' immune systems eliminated the virus without treatment, a rare phenomenon that researchers have not yet been able to fully explain. While the findings of this study are promising for future HIV treatment, researchers noted that this type of stem cell transplant is neither a low-risk nor an easily scalable procedure. During the course of such treatment, the patient's immune system is essentially destroyed and replaced through the transplant. And the mutation that protects against HIV infection is rare, detected only in a small percentage of people of Northern European descent. The story is a big deal.
Hmm.
Bone marrow transplants have been used effectively for leukemia and other cancers for a long time, though they're medically and individually challenging. This may be a variation of that, but using these very rare stem cells from a very rare HIV-resistant donor, this treatment will likely not be widely available until it's both clinically proven, well understood, and that stem cells can be cloned or artificially induced. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what I was, what I thought of while reading this article was actually, for some reason, the opposition that conservatives in the U.S. seem to have towards stem cell, medical advances in general, stem cell experiments in general. And I know that a lot of that argument is tied up with their anti-abortion arguments and these sorts of things, but I have to wonder if there is a not insignificant portion of it that knows that in some way, shape, or form, it could be used to help marginalized groups that they don't like. For example, HIV, who the primary people who experience that in the U.S. are members of the LGBT community, people that they don't particularly like, a minority they don't particularly like. So, you know, I think...
they believe in a right to life until yeah. they don't.
Until they don't. Exactly. But
it's very complicated for them.
Yeah. Putting all that aside, this is great news. I really hope that the treatment works at scale and can be, made more available and can help save more lives.
This kind of thing is really complex. If I'm understanding the process correctly, if it's similar to what I know or what I believe I know, essentially, what they do is they subject the person to radiation to destroy the marrow that creates the white blood cells that provide immunity. Yep. So they end up having to be in a completely isolated, sterile space until they can get a new implant of stem cells or a marrow transplant and then take the time to recreate an immune system, which, by the way, is not their original DNA. Which makes them a chimera, technically speaking. It's a very, very physically challenging, medically challenging, costly, difficult kind of cure.
Yeah.
But it's progress. It's something. And at least now they may have a direction.
Mm.
Okay, you have been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, and bigger partner is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you found the show interesting. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope you'll tune in again next week. Take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
Relevant talk. Information and great music. This is Community Media, KPFT.
With all the things that are happening in the world today, sometimes you just want to escape. KPFT provides sanity and great music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's also available online at kpft.org. That means you can take us anywhere you go. And also, while you're there, become a sustaining member. It's safe, secure, and easy to do. For all the times you just want to get away, for all the times you just want to smile and enjoy the music styles, from smooth jazz to soul and a whole lot more, let the next sound be your phone. Call 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. And thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, the host of Writer's Voice, heard every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. on KPFT's HD2 channel. Tune in each week for in-depth conversation with writers of all genres about matters both timely and timeless. That's every Sunday morning, 8 to 9 a.m. on HD2. And remember to donate to kpft.org today.
It's Friday night, the inmates go quiet. Listen, poor boys, listen. It's time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT at